It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later on, we'll take a look at a new bill coming up for a vote tomorrow that would take investigations of deaths that happen in police custody out of the hands of police.
But first, our next guest says that decisions made by six industries, including food, tobacco, and alcohol, have a greater impact on our health today than the decisions made by scientists and policymakers.
He says the profit-motivated practices of these industries correlates with the rise of non-communicable diseases and healthcare costs. And he says that if the United States and the world want to achieve their goals of better health for all, we need to reboot the system that values profits above public health.
Joining us right now is Nicholas Freudenberg. He is a professor of public health and the founder and the director of Corporations and Health Watch. His new book that we'll be discussing is Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumptions, and Protecting Public Health. Nicholas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thanks for having me, Gene.
I want to talk about those six areas right away, because right in your book you say that you have friends and colleagues who said, why did you pick these, and why didn't you focus on more industries? You've taken a look at alcohol, the automobile industry, firearms, food and beverages, pharmaceuticals, and tobacco. Talk about the process and how you arrived at these particular six.
Sure. I think there are three reasons why I picked these six. First is that they're really mainstays of the global consumer economy. These six industries play an important role in what gets sold to consumers, and that's really the biggest part of the global economy. Consumer expenditures really drive the rest of the economy. Second, these six products are associated with the majority of deaths in the world today. The World Health Organization put out a report a few years ago saying that tobacco, alcohol, and unhealthy food were prime drivers of chronic illnesses, which now kill something like 60% of the people, account for 60% of the deaths in the world today. And I also think these six industries have been well studied, and so we really have ample evidence documenting their role in premature deaths and preventable illnesses and injuries. So I wanted to summarize what we know about them and really put on the public agenda, seeing if we can rebalance the responsibilities of individuals, government, and corporations for health.
So sort of the scope of the industries, their impact on the world, and then also that important fact that you mentioned there, the fact there's lots of data about it. They've got a history. There's been a lot written and a lot of research done.
Correct.
Now, one of the things you also mention in your book is that we are at what you call a turning point. And describe that turning point for us, if you will, and why now in this point in our history?
Yes, I think for the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a steady drift towards corporations taking more responsibility for political and economic decisions and governments stepping back from their responsibility, particularly to protect public health and the environment. And my fear is that we're reaching a point where the consequences of that freeing corporations to make decisions without public oversight is having a very dramatic effect on illness and health. Chronic diseases and injuries are now the leading killers in our society, and those two health conditions are closely linked to the six industries that I write about in the book.
And part of what you talk about in the book is what you call the corporate consumption complex. And talk about that concept, if you would.
Sure. By corporate consumption complex, I refer to the consumer corporations in these six and related industries, their trade associations, the law firms, the public relations firms, the scientists they hire, the media that they sponsor. And my argument is that this corporate consumption complex promotes what I call hyperconsumption, a pattern of lifestyle, health behaviors, and social environments that contribute to premature death and preventable illness. And the public health world needs to, and the social movements that are looking for a healthier, more sustainable world, in my view, need to take on this corporate consumption complex, which I borrowed from the term that Dwight Eisenhower used, the military-industrial complex, which he said in 1961 was a threat to our democracy and well-being. And my argument is today it's that corporate consumption complex which is undermining public health, threatening our democracy, and even jeopardizing the environment that sustains life.
And you say threatening our democracy, but it also has other governments are involved here too, right? We're not just talking the United States.
Absolutely. It's a global problem. And I think a closer look at tobacco illustrates that well. Tobacco, in some ways, is a success story. We've cut smoking rates in half. Many fewer people are dying tobacco-related deaths in the United States. But what the tobacco industry did as a result of those successes was to begin marketing its products in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And the estimates are that 100 million people died prematurely because of tobacco in the 20th century, but that 1 billion people, 1 billion, will die prematurely in this century unless we dramatically change the promotion of tobacco and the uptake of it by people in the developing world.
And, you know, tobacco is an interesting example because here in the United States, smoking is on a slightly different track. You know, there are no smoking zones all over the place. But as you point out, in the rest of the world, tobacco is still very big and very much a going concern.
Yes, growing, in fact. The estimates are that something like a billion people, 1.3 billion people around the world are smoking. And that is just imposing a huge tax on productivity, on health care, and of course on human suffering, because the deaths from tobacco are terrible deaths, cancer and heart disease and other kinds of deaths.
So as you look at the other industries that you're focusing on, whether it's automobiles or alcohol, firearms, or what have you, are they sort of arriving at this consumption model all by themselves? Is there some sort of collusion here, or is it just the profits are driving everything and they're all winding up in the same place?
Well, I call it a complex because I think they do work together, and not in a secret conspiracy. It's not SMERSH, but rather they use the same public relations firms, the same lawyers, the same advertising agencies, and those supports that they use have found ways to exploit people's vulnerabilities. For example, people evolved with a craving for sugar, fat, and salt. And when we were in the savanna, that where we faced starvation, that then stoking up on these ingredients helped to ensure survival. But today, it leads to death and disease. But the food companies, to give one example, are exploiting that vulnerability and creating what some people call hyper-palatable products, products that are laced with sugar, fat, and salt to make it irresistible. And the brain signals that are triggered by some of these foods are not so different from the ones triggered by addictive substances like tobacco, alcohol, and illegal drugs.
We're talking with Nicholas Freudenberg, the author of Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. He says American industries have produced a culture that promotes consumption over well-being. And he further argues that needs to change. And we'd like to hear from you, too. What would you like to see done to challenge this model? Is this model, in your mind, a problem? Are you personally involved with any public health efforts that are taking on industries such as food, alcohol, or tobacco? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Nicholas Freudenberg, author of the book Lethal But Legal, and inviting you to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're talking about what he says the impact of industries such as food and alcohol and tobacco are. In fact, he says they have a greater impact on today's public health than decisions made by scientists and policymakers. Do you agree with that? 800-642-1234. 1234 is our toll-free number, and you can also post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. Nicholas, before we take calls, we've got some lining up here. I did mention that spending on scientists and policymakers. How do you measure that? How can you come up with those numbers?
Well, there are fortunately organizations that tally the spending on campaign contributions and lobbying. And we know there's been a huge increase, especially after the Supreme Court Citizen United decision. And one of the problems have been we have the most corporate-friendly Supreme Court in the last several decades now. One number that always shocks me is that each year the tobacco, alcohol, and food industries spend about $25 billion trying to encourage people to use their mostly unhealthy products. And that is more than twice our total expenditure for all the activities of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. So we're spending far more in this society on encouraging people to be unhealthy than we are in promoting public health. And that doesn't make sense. That's not a moral or ethical approach, and government really has a responsibility to better protect the well-being of our population.
You know, when you went into this book, I imagine you had a thesis that this would be the case, and I'm wondering if you were surprised by what you found.
Well, here's what surprised me. We always thought of the tobacco industry as a pariah industry, and what I found is that while the products of the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry, for example, are quite different because we need food, we need drugs, the strategies they use actually follow the playbook of the tobacco industry. And they misrepresent science, they discredit critics and opponents, they try and dominate the media, they lobby extensively, they undermine legislation that looks to protect public health. And so that was very disturbing, that the tobacco industry has written the playbook for corporate America for this period.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got listeners who would like to join in. We begin with Ben, and Ben joins us from Fenimore. Hi.
Hi. I'm just touching on the whole America thing. It's America. It's a free country, and, you know, I don't smoke, I don't chew or anything like that, but you know, I do support not smoking in the bars and all that stuff. But as far as restricting people on, you know, telling them, you know, don't smoke or forcing them not to smoke, backing them into that corner, to me it ain't right. You know, it's a free country. It's do what you want, you know. I mean, as long as you're not harming other people, I don't see any harm in it.
Ben, thanks for the call. And what about that argument, Nicholas, that this is America, this is a free country, and people should be able to make their own rational decisions about what they choose to do?
Yes, I'm very much welcome the fact that we live in a free country. And I'm all for individuals taking responsibility for their health. But I think then we also need to put a demand on corporations that they take responsibility. And no one and is talking about prohibiting tobacco, about prohibiting unhealthy food or alcohol. What I'm raising the question of is how much do we want to let corporations promote their use? How much do we want to have social resources spent encouraging people to use products that will contribute to premature illness and terrible deaths? And I think actually no parent wants to see their child addicted. No parent wants to have their children be at risk of diabetes or lung cancer or other terrible diseases. And so they're looking to government to protect their children, to protect young people from the undue influence that I think these industries are having.
So how fine a line is that if what you're worried about here is that promotion? Because then you start treading on some very American things like the First Amendment.
Well, the First Amendment only recently was extended to protect commercial speech. That was a decision in the 1970s, and before that time, it was seen correctly, I believe, as protecting political speech. Now that right has also been extended to corporations. But Oliver Wendell Holmes said, the First Amendment does not give people the right to yell fire falsely in a crowded theater. And to my mind, making false health claims about products like foods and alcohol and tobacco is a slow-motion version of falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Jeff is with us, and Jeff is in Madison. Hi.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I certainly share your guest concerns regarding the marketing tactics of tobacco companies, alcohol, what have you, but I guess I'm wondering what are we going to do to protect us now that we're legalizing marijuana in more and more states? What is to protect us from, I'll call it marijuana companies, using the same marketing tactics to drive more and more of us to become addicted on what has proven to be a very addictive substance?
Nicholas Freudenberg, I don't know if you, this is not addressed in your book, I don't think, but what about that idea that there are other things out there, say the legalization of marijuana, that could fall right into this same sort of playbook? Is this?
Yes, I worry about that too. I support the decriminalization of our approach to substance abuse and addiction and moving it more into a public health model. But I think what the problem is promoting substances that undermine health with inadequate government oversight. Everyone agrees that the government has some responsibilities for oversight. Nobody is arguing for distributing heroin to children. So the question that we debate is where to draw the line. And I think what we've seen in the last 30, 40 years is moving that line steadily rightward to letting corporations do whatever they want with immunity. And when the costs of that are borne by their consumers and by citizens and by taxpayers, that doesn't seem right. So I think we need to rebalance that line so that there's a higher degree of responsibility on the part of corporations for the costs that the products that they promote impose on individuals and on society as a whole.
So how do you go about doing that? You know, taking on any one of these particular industries, it seems to me, would be a daunting task. And then you combine them all into this overarching messaging issue, and it seems impossible. So how do you create something that's going to address all of these concerns with all of these various industries? And the trick, I think, might be, how do you do it in a way where it would ultimately be successful?
Yes, I think that is the challenge. But I'm optimistic for a few reasons. I'm optimistic because I think we've seen in American history that several times in the last century or so, the American people, scientists, journalists, reform movements have come together to redraw the lines between corporation and government and the public. And I think we're entering a time where people will see the necessity of doing that. I'm also optimistic because I think most people want a society where they don't have to worry about their child's health, want a society where they can count on the government to protect their health against false claims, misleading claims, and so on. And I think if we look at the food movement that has been emerging over the last several years, more and more Americans are saying we want healthy food. We want to move away from this industrialized food system. It took 50 years to get public action on tobacco, so it's not going to be overnight. But I think our success in tobacco shows that you can mobilize people with a combination of evidence and good arguments and plain old community organizing.
And so in your estimation, what would a good policy agenda look like if you're going to accomplish those goals and, I guess, taking the long view, do it over a period of time?
Yes. In the book, I recommend five or six strategies. The first is to develop stronger right-to-know and duty-to-disclose laws, right-to-know for consumers, duty-to-disclose for companies. If they know that one of their products is harming people, they ought to have an obligation to disclose that. That isn't the case today. Second, we ought to no longer allow corporations to pass on to consumers and taxpayers the health costs that their products generate. We saw in the tobacco settlement of 1998 that the tobacco industry had to pay billions of dollars to state governments to compensate the public for what we had to pay for taking care of people with tobacco-related diseases. Third, I think we need to really stop marketing particularly unhealthy products to children. Several other free market societies have found that it isn't fair and doesn't make sense to advertise unhealthy products to children. And finally, we need to do a better job of leveling the playing field. Corporations really have an undue influence in our political system through lobbying and campaign contributions and revolving door, and we need to fix those gaps in our democracy so that ordinary people have a stronger voice in setting government health policy.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, but are you optimistic that, something will happen, that this discussion will take place?
Yes, I think it's happening all around the country. I think food is a very clear example. I think a lot of people are looking at the role of the pharmaceutical industry, and I also think there's action around the world. So I'm optimistic that people will be concerned about their own health, the future health of the planet, and that they will act to prevent the terrible future of our children dying sooner than our current generation does.
Nicholas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Nicholas Freudenberg is a professor of public health and the founder and director of Corporations and Health Watch. His new book is Lethal But Legal: Corporations, Consumptions, and Protecting Public Health.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about some words that have disappeared from the English language.
First, as things currently stand in Wisconsin, if someone dies as a result of excessive force from a police officer, that death is investigated with the police department itself.
But under a new bill that is set for a vote in the state assembly tomorrow, that could change. Representatives Gary Bies of Sister Bay and Chris Taylor of Madison have sponsored legislation that would turn that investigation over to an outside agency.
While the bill has support from statewide police organizations, members of the City of Milwaukee government have pushed back, saying reforms are unnecessary, even as the Milwaukee Police Department has been criticized recently for using excessive force. Here to talk about the bill is Representative Chris Taylor of Madison. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start by putting this into context. How common is it to see the use of excessive force by Wisconsin law enforcement?
Well, you know, in just the last year here in Madison, we have had 3 officer-involved deaths. So the issue is really about that, is when is it appropriate to use deadly force? And in our own community here, we have seen an increase in the use of deadly force against civilians. So that really it kind of inspired this bill.
Yeah, can you share with us some of the stories that spurred the creation?
Well, there's been probably the best known incidents, unfortunately, that occurred is one that is not at all far from my home, and that was the death of Paul Heenan, who was an unarmed civilian. Kind of strange circumstance, but he was intoxicated. It was very early in the morning, went into the wrong home, and without walking back to his home with his neighbor, when he was shot by a police officer who was called to the scene. And that ended in there is no criminal charges being brought against the officer. The officer, though, did end up resigning based on some other allegations that came out after this incident. So the officer did not ever return to law enforcement. But that was an incident that really shook up my community. I think the other kind of horrific incident happened in Milwaukee, and that involved Derek Williams, who was the man who was apprehended on suspicion of committing a crime that he did not commit, and he had a condition, an asthma attack and ended up suffocating in the back of the police car. So I think that the time really is right to look at how these incidents are investigated, and I think, and I know that my co-author, Representative Bies, really thought that it would be much better for the public, and I think better for law enforcement, to get to a more independent, more transparent process in how these incidents are investigated.
Well, how are they investigated right now as it stands?
It's agency by agency, but for the most part, you have agencies investigating their own officers. So you could have very easily a colleague of the officer involved or someone who worked with the officer quite closely actually doing the investigation into whether the officer committed a crime, which, you know, at its best, I think raises a perception of bias. And I think at the worst does raise the issue of bias. But currently it's kind of an agency by agency determination. This bill would really set a framework and say that the lead investigator cannot be from the agency where the officer accused of of being involved with the office in the death was employed. And it also would require an additional investigator to be from another agency. So really, the bill is trying to get to a more impartial, more independent model of how these investigations are done.
So you're describing a team of two that would not be internal. They'd be from an outside agency. Are you worried at all that an outside perspective like that might not have the depth of knowledge and just sort of the knowledge of the lay of the land that someone on the inside may have?
Well, you know, we crafted the bill to allow a lot of flexibility for the agency, so we're not dictating who it should be. We want to make sure that anything we're imposing on law enforcement, that it's going to work for them. And so the issue of who it actually is left to that particular agency. So I don't see any reason why that agency wouldn't pick somebody who is very experienced in doing this. But we do leave that decision to the individual agency, and the bill just says you have to get an investigator from another agency. So, you know, I think in general it's a real improvement. You could argue that, well, maybe this person won't have the experience, but hopefully the agency will solicit someone who does. And I think it lends an impartiality that currently is just not present in how these investigations are done.
There's been mixed response to the bill. It has gotten support from the Police Association and the Sheriff's Association, but officials in Milwaukee have said that they don't think the reforms are necessary because they think that the pathologists, the prosecutors, the law enforcement officers, that they all share a common goal, and that is to be fair and objective, and that there are already layers of oversight. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, the bill has mostly, in fact, I haven't heard of anybody opposing this bill. It's supported by the police union. It's supported by the Badger Sheriff. The chief of police have withdrawn any concern they had about the bill. The advocates and families who have been involved are supporting the bill. So I haven't heard specifically that Milwaukee has any problems with this bill. In fact, I believe that Milwaukee's policy currently does comply with the bill, come really close to complying with the bill. So if they have a concern, it certainly has not reached my ears, nor do I believe it's been communicated to Representative Byes. We have worked really, really hard. This is now, we're on the third version of this bill, to make sure that we have a bill that has the buy-in from law enforcement, but also has the buy-in from the public and from advocates and families that have been so impacted by this issue.
Right. So I gather that the city of Milwaukee's position is listed as undisclosed, but those comments have come from officials within the city. And I guess regardless of what you've heard about those specific remarks, do you think there's anything to that, that the oversight is already there?
Well, you know, I think that they do have a process in Milwaukee that is relatively new. But Milwaukee has had some very, very egregious situations. I just talked about one, the Derrick Bell situation, which was a horrible instance where eventually a special prosecutor was called and there was a grand jury that was brought in, and they believe there were charges that should have been brought against the officers, and the special prosecutor refused to bring those charges. So, you know, if Milwaukee is complying with this, they shouldn't have anything to worry about. But everybody should be held in the state to the same standard. And that's really what this bill does, is say, look, you need to follow this framework. The framework gives a lot of flexibility, however. But everybody is going to be required to make sure an outside investigator is leading the investigation. And so I would hope that Milwaukee sees the value in this. And I do think, as I said, their policy is coming, it either complies or it's extremely close to complying with this state law.
I want to ask you a little bit more about Milwaukee. I understand a former version of the bill excluded Milwaukee from these reforms, and then it was put back in. Can you talk about why that was?
Sure. Well, you know, we were obviously, Representative Byes and myself, were working very diligently to craft something that law enforcement bought into. We didn't want to impose something on law enforcement that they did not think would work for them. And so we did toy with taking Milwaukee out completely. You know, that wasn't the best solution, though, in my opinion. We actually got everyone around a table once more and went back to the drawing board because there was a lot of people very unhappy about that, which I understood why. It kind of went back to some of the core principles that were in the original bill. And this language of requiring two outside investigators really was the core piece of the bill. from the inception of the bill. And so we started again talking to law enforcement, and they thought that that was actually a much better option, and that was language that they could accept and that they thought was good, and advocates as well. So that's kind of how we got back to that language. Again, I'm really proud of this bill. I think this bill is a consensus bill. We have heard really positive things about it. We have law enforcement that is supporting or not opposing the bill at this point, and we have families and advocates who believe it's a good step forward. So I think we came up with something that really does address the needs of most of the voices that we were communicating and most of the people who were at the table.
Another issue that's been raised in Wisconsin is deaths and sometimes suicides of prisoners. Now, is that something you'd like to see looked at a little more closely as well?
Well, that is covered in the bill. So an officer-involved death is the death of an individual that results directly from an action or an omission of a law enforcement officer. So that is something that would be covered in this bill as well. But it does seem like we've seen more and more incidents of that occurring as well. So that is something that is included in the bill.
Of prisoners.
Right. It's anybody who is in the custody of law enforcement.
I see.
And so a prisoner would be in the custody of law enforcement. And because of an act or an omission of an act, there was a death that resulted. There's also, you know, the instance of these high-speed chases. That's another instance where we've had an incident in Madison where we had a high-speed chase that resulted in the person being chased, being hurt. So that is another instance that would be covered in the bill.
So this bill goes to a vote in the Assembly tomorrow. What are the prospects, do you think?
I think it's going to do really well, and it's going to pass, and I suspect we're going to see a lot of bipartisan support for this bill. I'm, of course, always optimistic. I'm hoping for an unanimous vote, so we'll see if we can get everybody, if we can get a unanimous vote. But I think it's going to, you know, receive a lot of support. People know that there's been a lot of discomfort with how officer-involved deaths are investigated. We're moving away from the internal investigation to more of an unbiased, independent investigation. I think the time is right. We've had enough incidents of these officer-involved shootings and deaths that I think the public really is ready to move, and I think law enforcement is ready to look at an alternative model.
Representative Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Representative Chris Taylor about her proposed legislation that would turn investigations of deaths in custody over to organizations outside the police department. That bill goes to a vote in the Assembly tomorrow. In the hour or two you set aside each day to ponder deep questions about the English language, do you ever find yourself wondering why can we be inept but not ept? Why unkempt but not kempt? Well, you've stumbled on what language experts call unmatched pairs.
And it's true. I have been spending a couple hours a day pondering this every day. So we've got one of our favorite language experts with us today to help sort all of that out. Grant Barrett is a journalist, a lexicographer, and co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. Grant, welcome back.
Hello there.
Well, I want to start you very thoughtfully, I have to say, for the purposes of this discussion, provided me with a short poem. I'm not going to read all of it, but it sort of outlines what we're talking about here with these unmatched words. And the poem, the first verse of it, is called A Very Descript Man, and give credit where credit is due. It was written by J.H. Parker, first printed in Collier's Magazine back in the 1940s. So here's the first verse. I am such a dolent man. I eptly work each day. My acts are all basilic. I've just ain't things to say. And so that sort of outlines what these words are like. It also demonstrates that this is an issue, if you can call it that, that's been around for quite some time.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have this kind of innate sense on the value of words that has something to do with things that aren't about their meaning or their definition. So we call this pragmatics in linguistics, where we have little flags attached to words. And with these particular words, we have a flag that says, I don't know the antonym. So big, we know the antonym is little is a good one for that, and happy and sad and fat and skinny and so forth. But if you say somebody is indolent, you're like struggling for its opposite number. What is its? Who is its partner in language? We're missing that. And you can start to slowly build this list over time and say, wait a second, I don't know what the opposite incognito is. Is it cognito? If I travel everywhere with my name on a badge, am I traveling cognito? I don't really know.
If you're kempt, unkempt, where did kempt go? Inept, are you apt in all of those sorts of things? So I've heard this term lost positives. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's the same thing, exactly. Or unmatched pairs, lost positives. And it all depends upon this very interesting thing about words. Each of them travels alone. They might be a part of a caravan, if we want to take this metaphor pretty far, but for the most part, their history is dependent upon accidents. So if you do have a pair of words like kempt or unkempt, unkempt has traveled well and has lasted and has been used, but kempt somehow doesn't exist anymore. Or if it does exist, it exists in a different form. Unkempt is super interesting because it's related to the word combed, as in I combed my hair. And what we have here then is this where the C traded for a K, where the T used for the past participle is actually an ED in the other word, the unvoiced P versus the voiced B, and there you have it. It kempt and combed are actually the same word etymologically. They both mean combed. But we just got the form kempt attached to unkempt and kept it. So it's this preserved archaism. It's a mosquito in amber, as it were.
So is there any move ever afoot to resurrect some of these words? Like, let's use kempt for a good example, as long as we're talking about that. Or is it once they're gone, they're never coming back?
Well, there are a lot of people like you and me and our listeners who do love to resuscitate these words, usually with a little bit of a joke in mind or irony, humor. They show up in book titles, humorous essays, doggerel, bits of jokes and poems. So mainly they're kept alive by artificial resuscitation. They're put in life support, usually with humor attached.
So do you suppose in this age of, you know, YouTube and the internet, that there's more of a possibility now that one of these might catch some sort of viral fire and come alive for at least a little while?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a downside to that. It's probably true that they're more likely to catch fire at all because of the modern age and how fast things spread. But at the same time, they're also just as likely to burn out and burn out super fast. So it's a problem. You can the last month's fad is completely forgotten, and it's the same with language. We use these things. We enjoy them for a while. They're funny for a while, and then they wear themselves out really quickly.
So speaking of fads, why is it that one form of a word sticks around forever and ever and ever, and then the other form does disappear? It falls off the map, and eventually we can't even remember what it was.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you remember where you learned most of the words that you know?
School, maybe?
Yeah, there we go. So that's the question. Most of the time, one of the things we don't have attached to most of the words that we know is where we first learned them. For when a word is put into our own lexicon, into our personal vocabulary, our idiolect, it belongs to us, and it's modified every time we use it, every time it's added to a particular person's lexicon. And in this way, they change over time. Now, some of us, let's say the great writers of the day, or the great playwrights, or the great orators, or even just a professor at a university who has 500 kids a semester, right? These are people who have influence. And so their particular use of a word is more likely to be spread and is more likely to continue. And so through accidents of history, their particular idiolects become a little more standard, and they're able to spread their particular oddities. So if you have a favorite word, you ever realize that you've been using a word too much?
Oh, yes.
And, somehow it keeps coming out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. Well, now imagine that you do that every day and lots of people are listening. In that way, you can affect language change.
Well, I'm working on that on the radio right now by using unusual words every single day and seeing who listens. But, you know, we've been spending an inordinate amount of time on unkempt. What other favorites do you have?
Well, a lot of people like to ask disheveled. You know, she had disheveled hair when she rose in the morning. Disheveled is really interesting. We do tend to associate it with hair, which is amazing because the disheveled part of it comes from the French word cheveux for hair. In French, they have a very similar word. It's not déchevelé. It's E-C-H-E-V-E-L-E. So they use a different negative in the front of the root, which means hair, to indicate that the hair is in disarray or out of order. But we did get it from the French, and we inherited only that form of the word from the French. You don't wake up, or you don't go to the salon and walk out with disheveled hair after having your hair done, right? So a lot of the words that we have where we don't have the pairs is because we got them from French or German or another language, and we only borrowed one half of the pair. It's kind of like adopting only one twin or only one triplet in some cases and leaving the other one for another family to take into their home.
Any very American versions of this?
I'm sorry?
Like a really American version of an unmatched word.
Oh, most of these are old. Most of these predate even the founding of the United States as a country. I don't have a particularly American one. No, I don't. There's a ton to discuss, though. I think the Americans, like the Australians, have a particular knack for playing with these archaic forms, and we like to speak in a really low slang and then throw in these fancy words once in a while just to kind of raise an eyebrow at people and say, see, I don't, you know, I'm not only about slang, I do the highfalutin talk.
So we've only got about 30 seconds left. Are there any words in it that we use now that you could see in a century or two might wind up in this category?
Oh, no, that's too much. I do want to say that one of my favorite words to talk about when unmatched pairs is ruthless, because ruthy would be a word that would mean pity, or it would mean consideration for a person's negative situation. So when you talk about the ruthless, you mean lacking in pity. And I have found that people have trying to use ruth in a non-ironic way, throwing it into the writing. She had great ruth, and she cared for the children like they were her own. That's really interesting. So we may see that ruth comes back as a new matched pair.
All right. Well, Grant, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Grant Barrett, our go-to guy for all things linguistic, also a journalist, co-host of the public radio show Away With Words.